We are pleased to have as our speaker in this Founders Day Assembly, President Emeritus Ernest L. Wilkinson, who served for 2 decades as President of Brigham Young University. This was its period of greatest growth, from approximately 5,000 students to 25,000 students, and from a handful of buildings to the magnificent campus we enjoy. In so many ways, in so many places, President Wilkinson's genius is impressed upon this campus, and we are all indebted to him and to the great people who worked under his direction. Brigham Young University was founded 99 years ago this month. A year from now, we will have the formal centennial observance in the midst of the centennial year, which begins next April. President Wilkinson is currently editing the definitive centennial history of Brigham Young University. 2 years ago, in our Founders Day Assembly, he shared with us some insights as a result of his research to that point. Today, we will be the beneficiaries of his work, which is now maturing and is even now beginning to be set in type at the Brigham Young University Press. We're grateful to President Wilkinson for undertaking this monumental task and for sharing with us on this Founders Day his message about the history of Brigham Young University. It's a great privilege now to hear from President Emeritus Ernest L. Wilkinson.
My brothers and sisters, I find that writing the history of the Brigham Young University is in some respects more difficult than being its president for 20 years. Because as president, within the limitations provided by the Board of Trustees, I could make my own decisions and let others either praise or gripe about them. As historian, I have become the critic and appraiser of 8 presidents whose terms of office will last 100 years, with a student body beginning of 29 elementary and high school students, now enlarged to over 25,000 college students and 247,000 involved in off-campus programs. You'll appreciate that to put this 100-year history in a 40-minute speech will require a lot of condensing. All I can hope to do is to give you certain distinctive characteristics of each administration. And so here goes. The founding of Brigham Young University, or Academy, the predecessor of Brigham Young University, was preceded by 2 elementary schools, one after the other, founded by Warren and Wilson Dusenberry, 2 brothers who were non-Mormons. They were later converted to the church. Their school, originally known as the Dusenberry School, became so successful and popular that the last one was taken over as a branch of the University of Deseret, the predecessor of the University of Utah. It grew to have 300 students. That dwindled to 221, but even then it was twice the size of the mother institution in Salt Lake City, which had only 116. Because, however, of lack of support by the University of Deseret and its inability to generate enough tuition to carry on, it had to close. Fortunately, by that time, Brigham Young himself had been contemplating the founding of a school to be given his name. He came forward, and in October of 1875, 99 years ago this month, made a deed of gift of 2 1/10 acres of lands in the center of Provo to found the university, Academy at that time. Warren Dusenberry, one of the 2 brothers who founded the Dusenberry Schools, was elected its principal, with the understanding that he would be only temporary and be succeeded by a permanent president. It was to be a private school, not an institution of the church. A local board of trustees was to manage its affairs, although in reality and practice, it relied on either Brigham Young or the church primarily for support. Dusenberry had begun the practice of law and did not have much time to give to the school. He himself proposed Carl G. Mazur as first principal. While President Young was deciding whether or not to appoint Mazur or someone else, There was a terrific explosion in the northern part of Salt Lake City, which practically destroyed the rooms in a meeting house where Carl G. Mazur was teaching school. He was the first convert to the church from Germany and from Saxony. He sought out his bishop, a brother Sharp, and found him in the office of Brigham Young. And without any formalities of any kind, Mazur bolted into the office to tell of the tragedy which would deprive him of his teaching opportunities. Brigham Young immediately turned to him and said, "Brother Mazur, that's all right. We have another mission for you." Having served three missions already, Mazur later explained that he was about ready to go through the floor. But Brigham then explained that he had started a school in Provo and wanted to go there as its principal. Mazur came back the next day and accepted. When asked for instructions, the only reply was, "You are to teach, not to teach, even the multiplication tables without the inspiration of the Lord." That has ever since been the hallmark of this institution. Since the school, however, was not church-supported, President Young knew it was necessary for him to have trustees with a very strong man as chairman, to whom he gave the financial responsibility, mind you, for operating the school. Some years previous, he had called to his office Abraham O. Smoot and told him he wanted him to go to Provo and help to colonize that place and be president of the stake. Brother Smoot indignantly demurred. He pointed out he was mayor of Salt Lake City, which he'd been reelected several times. He was a federal office holder. He had already served three missions for the church. And he now, for the first time in his life, he had been able to build a home in which his family was comfortably situated. He had also engaged in several explorations and settlements for the church. He thought that Brigham had a lot of nerve in asking him to go and build up a new city in Zion. Brigham, who was not accustomed to members of the church taking exception to what he said, looked him straight in the eye and said, "Brother Smoot, you can either go to Provo or you can go to hell." He decided to come to Provo. Later on, some of the Smoot family moved to Texas, and they enlarged that story by saying that Brigham said, "You can either go to Provo, you can go to Texas, or you can go to hell." Some have questioned whether that gave him any more latitude. With the calling of Brother Mazur, President Young made Smoot chairman of the Board of Trustees and gave him the added responsibility of financing the Brigham Young Academy. Dusenberry served only into the early part of 76 when Mazur assumed the principalship in the new school. Mazur started with 29 students and served for a period of 16 years until 1892, and they were his servants. They were all either elementary or high school students. One of the first ones to enroll was George Sutherland, a non-member of the church who later became an associate justice of the United States Supreme Court. In an address which he gave to the graduating class of BYU in the 1940s, he described the students in those pioneering days in these words. "Their weekday attire at the maximum consists of a hat of ancient vintage, sometimes with a well-developed hole through the crown, of which a lock of hair might be made to wave like the plume of an Indian on the warpath, a hickory shirt the worse for wear, a pair of pants handed down perhaps from a former tenant, held in place by one suspender, or allowed to defy the force of gravity with the sole and precarious support afforded by the contours of an immature body. For one to appear among his fellows with any marked elaboration upon this attire was to invoke ironic, not to say insulting, remarks, often so cautiously phrased as to send the misguided lad to the shelter of his home in tears. Nobody worried about child labor. The average boy of 10 worked, and worked hard along with the older members to support the family. He milked, cut and carried in the night's wood, carried swill to the pigs, curried the horses, hoed the corn, guided the plow, or if not, followed it in the task of picking up potatoes which had been upturned until his young vertebra approached dislocation and he was ready to consider a bid to surrender his hopes of salvation in exchange for the comfort of a hinge in the small of his back. So much for the description of George Southern. And may I say that this attire was no more freakish in nature than the attempt of some male students to prove their masculinity by growing a beard and by trying at the same time to qualify as one of the fair sex by growing straggly long hair. But I haven't seen one yet who could compete with a woman in a beauty contest. Rather, each of them ought to enter the contest for the ugliest male on the campus. The 16-year period of Mazur's administration is a struggle for survival. On a number of occasions, the Board of Trustees did not know where they could raise enough money to carry on. One year, the faculty served without any salary. Tuition was generally paid in vegetables and other produce. The teachers had to go around the different homes to collect this produce in wheelbarrows. But no one had a deeper devotion to the church than Carl G. Mazur. He was the spiritual architect of this academy, and Abraham Smoot was its financial savior. Without the latter's personal fortune, which he used whenever the church permitted him, the school would never have survived. On several occasions, the school was threatened with closing, but Smoot never permitted that to happen. Without Abraham Smoot, neither this school nor Mazur would have survived. In addition to the academic poverty, Mazur found he had to compete with a large number of denominational schools throughout the territory, founded by the Presbyterians, the Methodists, the Baptists, and Congregationalists. The competition was keen because these sects raised millions of dollars throughout the United States for these schools to convert the benighted Mormons to Christianity. As a matter of fact, by 1888, there were 18 academies plus 72 elementary schools founded by these denominations, as compared with only 10 academies maintained by the church, of which the BY Academy was one. The leaders of these Protestant schools, however, soon came to realize that Mormon students came to their schools, enjoyed all their educational facilities, and then went back to their wards as leaders in the mutual improvement and other organizations of the church. So most of those competing schools were disbanded. Mormon students accepted the educational training of the other denominations but rejected their brand of Christianity. Mazur also had other trials and tribulations. At the beginning of one of the school terms in 1884, the academy, which was located on what is now Center Street and Third West, during one night, completely burned to the ground. The next day, Reed Smoot, a son of Abraham Smoot, and Reed later became senator in the United States, saw Brother Mazur on the street and said, "Brother Mazur, I'm sorry to know that Brigham Young Academy is burned." Brother Mazur looked up and said, "No, Brother Smoot, only the building is burned." And in 2 days, they had rented other headquarters and proceeded to teach again. These were also days when there was fierce prosecution and persecution of the saints who practiced polygamy. And Brother Mazur, in response to a request of the leaders of the church, the very year that he became principal, had taken his second wife. He had not wanted to do so, but was so loyal to the brethren that he accepted their advice. What is generally not understood about polygamy was that in many instances, polygamy was entered in to provide a home for women who would otherwise remain single, and not for the reasons generally ascribed. In common with others, Carl G. Mazur was arrested and tried for polygamy. He pleaded guilty before Judge Dusenberry, his predecessor, who had actually recommended him as principal of the school. Many of the stalwart citizens of Provo, including Southern, pleaded he not be given a prison sentence. The judge followed this recommendation, but gave him the maximum fine of $300. The next day, the students at Brigham Young Academy, in a devotional assembly, raised the $300 and paid the fine. In 1888, Mazur was appointed superintendent of schools and began to organize church schools throughout the territory in opposition or competition with the BYA. This inflamed Smoot, the chairman of his board, who thought a man could not serve two masters. So in 1890, it was agreed that in 1892, Mazur would retire as principal and devote his entire time to becoming superintendent of schools. In looking for a successor to Mazur, the board chose a convert from England, then 27 years of age, who had been on the faculty since he was 20 years of age, and who was probably the most brilliant and at the same time faithful member of the church on the faculty. His name was James E. Talmage. But before public announcement of this decision could be made, Talmage had been selected by the Brenner as president of the LDS College in Salt Lake City. So he never served as principal of this academy. The board then chose Benjamin Clough, Jr., who had just obtained his bachelor's degree from the University of Michigan, as assistant principal, with the understanding that he would become principal in 2 years. Except for their dedication to the church, Mazur and Clough were extreme opposites. Mazur was 63 years of age, staid in appearance, an adherent of the Prussian mythology of education, conservative, sober in manner. While Clough was only 34, vibrant, impetuous, and imbued with new educational ideas he had brought from Ann Arbor. Mazur advocated a closed society. Clough gloried in his stay at the University of Michigan and his association with the faculty there. To Mazur, evolution was taboo, and psychology was the kimmerer of the human mind. Clough's mind was open to new ideas. Mazur thought the church educational system, especially the Brigham Young Academy, could produce sufficient teachers to provide for the entire need of the church. Clough thought there was a lot in Gentile education that could be used here. Mazur began his educational career at 16 and received a sound German education with a very rich classical background. Clough, a product of Pioneer, Utah, did not enter the University of Michigan until he was 29. Mazur was harnessed and broken in. Clough seemed almost like an unbroken colt. Mazur had become accustomed to the deliberate and often slow speed of church machinery. Clough was impatient with delay. At the beginning of 1892, the school moved from downtown in the Aprovo into the new educational building on the lower campus, which was the first building on that block. Mazur bowed out as principal, and Clough took over. A few years later, Clough returned for a year to the University of Michigan for a master's degree, which was the highest degree held by anyone on the campus. Clough brought new innovations to the BYU, which he'd picked up in Michigan. He began real college work and separated the high school from the college students so that they had different classes and different training. He introduced college yells, which was an abomination to Mazur and certain members of the Board of Trustees. He introduced athletics, which Mazur, who was a member of the Board of Trustees, required him to abandon. Mazur's point of view, however, was in effect the prevailing point of view of university presidents at the time. The president of Cornell University was requested to allow a group of students of that institution to go to Michigan to play a football game. He refused the invitation on the following grounds. "I refuse to let 40 of our boys travel 400 miles merely to agitate a bag of wind." Like Mazur, 16 years with the university as principal, Clough's 12 years represented a struggle for survival. For in 1895, Abraham O. Smoot died, and the school could no longer rely upon him for financial support. 1 year later, in 1896, Clough proposed to the church incorporate BYU as an auxiliary organization. That had been proposed before, but refused. This time it was approved, and for the first time in its 21-year history, the church now had legal control of the university and by the same act was financially responsible for its operation. After being vice principal or president for about 10 years, Clough, with the express approval of the Board of Trustees, organized an expedition to travel to South America for proving the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. Besides himself, there was only one other faculty member in the party. The others were students. Well, the church leaders gave their consent. It was not to be a church expedition, but one merely sponsored by the Brigham Young University, which contributed the magnificent sum of $200 for their expenses. The members had to supply their own donkeys or horses and other equipment. There were 23 members in the party. George H. Brimhall was left in charge of BYU. When the party arrived at Nogales, the entrance to Mexico, they were denied admission, except upon payment of a large customs fee. And while President Clough was negotiating among the Mormon colonies in Juarez to help raise the fee, also to have it reduced, Brother Heber J. Grant, a member of the Council of the Twelve, visited the party at Nogales. President Clough and his assistant were in Juarez at the time, having further negotiations for entrance to Mexico. Brother Grant became convinced that these young men in the party did not have the experience to enter a foreign country. He was afraid for their lives. He thought, for one thing, they didn't have the proper leadership, and he had heard reports that the young men in their overland travels from Provo to Nogales had not always acted with proper decorum. He therefore returned to Salt Lake City and proposed to the First Presidency and Council of the Twelve that the expedition be called off. The general authorities agreed and had Joseph F. Smith, who was a councilman in the First Presidency and who was on his way to Mexico, report to Clough that it was the advice of the general authorities that the trip be abandoned. But Clough and some of his men were obdurate. They said they would rather die in the attempt than to give up. So they were given permission for a much smaller party to continue on their own responsibility and without any help from either the church or the Brigham Young Academy. Of the original party of 23, 15 therefore returned to Utah. The other 8 took 1.5 years to go balance the journey to Columbia, where they hoped to find Zarahemla. During this time, they suffered all kinds of hardships, privation, starvation, and serious and sometimes critical illness. Clough himself nearly lost his life in trying to ford a river. Others were bitten by scorpions and snakes, which made it impossible for them to travel for several days. At one time, they were actually arrested and thrown in jail and accused of murder. Finally, however, they arrived in Columbia, but by that time the country was in the midst of a revolutionary war, and the government denied them the right to further pursue their journey for fear they would be murdered. Disillusioned, discouraged, famished, and heartbroken, they finally had to abandon the expedition and return to Provo by ship by way of Cuba. One of the hardy souls, Chester Van Buren, stayed on alone to gather botanical specimens for the BYU. Had they followed the advice of Brother Grant, they would have saved themselves 18 months of misery and torture, but they had been given their free agency and they exercised it. Clough returned to Provo in 1902. During the 2 years he was away from Provo, many of the leaders of the church under whom he had served died, including Carl G. Mazur, President Lorenzo Snow, and George Q. Cannon, who originally urged Brigham Young to found the academy and who for over 25 years had been the main support of the institution in Salt Lake City. The school he found was far different from the one he left. It was enlarged in every way, including a new building. Nevertheless, Brimhall willingly surrendered his office to President Clough, his former teacher, who again took up the presidency. Clough had a very successful administration for the next 2 years. During his entire administration, the faculty had grown from 21 to 59. The student body had grown from 275 to 1,622. Tragically, Walter Wolfe, who was his assistant on his trip to Mexico, but who left the party before they arrived in Columbia, then preferred certain charges of misconduct against President Clough, including mismanagement, misrepresentation, misappropriation of funds, and immorality, which allegedly occurred during the Mexican expedition. He was then tried by the Board of Trustees. The charges so shocked him that he didn't even testify on his own behalf. Nevertheless, he was exonerated of all charges. However, the stigma attached to his public image was so great that even though he'd been found innocent, Clough resigned the presidency to return to Mexico as manager of a large rubber plantation. As one of his final acts at the academy, in November of 1903, he proposed to the board that it change the name of the school to Brigham Young University, which for all of his 14 years had been his aim. There followed a vigorous dispute in the Board of Trustees over this proposal. Thinking the school was not qualified to become a university, Anthon H. Lunds of the First Presidency vigorously opposed it, but was outvoted by his brethren. In his diary for the day, President Lung recorded, "I hope their hats will fit their swollen heads." Wolfe went to Washington, where he testified against the seating of Reed Smoot as senator. He later resigned from the academy. With Clough's resignation, the board began its search for a new president. Very shortly after Clough's return, Brimhall had taken seriously ill and spent most of 2 years in California and Canada trying to recuperate. But he had been so successful during the expeditionary trip of Clough that many of the board thought he ought to be recalled. Others thought that Joseph B. Keeler, who had been his first assistant, should be appointed. In a vote of the board, they reached an equal number of votes. One of the board members, however, Stephen Chipman, then changed his vote in favor of Brimhall, and he was formally elected as president. Brimhall was largely a self-educated man. He never had the academic training of either of his predecessors. He never entered the academy until he was 40 years of age. His education began and ended at the BYU before it had really acquired university status. But he was a dynamic speaker and had a certain homespun manner that appealed much to the people of his generation. He was a combination of both Clough and Mazur. And while these two men never got along with each other, Brimhall got along with both. He began immediately to engage a brilliant faculty, a number of whom had their PhDs, which gave the faculty a new scholastic appearance. But by 1910, Brimhall, in common with many universities, had allowed his faculty to assume so many administrative matters and duties that the administration was largely in the hands of the faculty. The new PhD members, who were probably the most popular of their members, began to forthrightly teach the doctrine of organic evolution with all of its implications. That brought violent controversy to the campus, which caused the Board of Trustees to intervene. Two of the most vocal advocates of the doctrine were discharged, and others subsequently resigned. Many thought that the BYU could not survive that crisis. The newspapers and even the faculty assumed that they had been discharged because of their teaching of evolution. Your centennial staff has researched this carefully and found that the teaching of evolution was not, per se, the real cause of their dismissal. It was because they were as intolerant of the views of others as others were intolerant of their views. The controversy was settled by President Joseph F. Smith, who in a diplomatic article explained that the church had no philosophy about the modus operandi employed by the Lord in his creation of the world. He advised, however, that because of the immaturity of the students, it would be wise as a matter of propriety, not of belief, to leave evolution out of discussion in the church schools. Otherwise, he said, we would develop a theological aristocracy in the church. This pretty much brought the controversy to an end, and despite gloomy forebodings, the school from then on during the approximately next 10 years, the Brimhall administration continued on its course, but was always in financial trouble. The church itself during this period had some rough financial years and was unable to give much support to the school. Because, however, of the evolution controversy, Brimhall from then pursued a very conservative policy and never again embarked into controversial fields. With the departure of those whose services were terminated and others who left in sympathy with him, Brimhall was once again able to assume the authority that should have always gone with his office. There are a number who think that the Brigham Young University during the closing years of Brimhall's administration was nothing more than a religious seminary. That is only partially true, for during that period of time, the Brigham Young University turned out some of its most renowned graduates, such as Franklin S. Harris, who succeeded him as president, Harvey Fletcher, who became the second in command at the Bell Laboratories, Vern Knudsen, who later became chancellor of the University of California at Los Angeles, Henry Aldous Dixon, who became president successfully of Weber College, Utah State Agricultural College, and then a congressman from Utah, David J. Wilson, who became a federal judge in Salt Lake in New York City, G. Oscar Russell, who became head of the largest phonetics laboratory of the country, at that time stationed at Ohio State University, A. Ray Alpin, who later became president of the University of Utah, and Robert Hinckley, who was chairman of the Civil Aeronautics Authority, in charge of all civil aviation in this country, and a number of others who became faculties of the colleges of the different universities in this state, including Wayne Hales of this university. Brimhall, during his administration, chose as his first counselor Joseph B. Keeler, who had been his rival for the presidency, and Edwin Hinckley as his second counselor. Despite his failure to be named president, Keeler was very loyal to Brimhall. In addition to his teaching load, he took care of the finances and kept the university on an even keel. Hinckley, who, like Brimhall, was a great orator, dreamed of the future. At about the time that Orville and Wilbur Wright took their first heavier-than-machine flight at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, Hinckley predicted to his class that he would live to see the day when a man would have breakfast in New York and have dinner in San Francisco. He was scoffed at by members of the faculty. Brother Keeler uprightly reprimanded him, but said he'd supposed he'd done no lasting harm because no one would believe such a fantastic story. Hinckley lived to see the dream come true. Unfortunately, he died before his son Robert, who was also a student at the Brigham Young University under Brimhall's administration, was appointed chairman of the Civil Aeronautics Authority in charge of all civil aviation in the United States. President Hinckley also forecast the time would come that the university, which was still on the lower campus, would extend all the way to Squaw Peak, including the language training mission. It's now that far. During the closing years of Brimhall's administration, he was physically so incapacitated with heart trouble that in order to preside over the student body assemblies held in Old College Hall on the lower campus, he was carried up the stairs by Ed Hinckley, one of his counselors, through a back stairway so that no one could see him. Hinckley's children, led by Robert, have now set up a large scholarship fund for students at this university. During the closing years of Brimhall's administration, the school lost its momentum and had fewer graduates than in prior years. I had the privilege of attending the last class under Brimhall. There were only 12 graduates. So you can see why it was possible for me to be president of my class and editor of the school paper, because there were practically no one else to do it. Brimhall was succeeded at BYU by Franklin S. Harris, who graduated from the institution during Brimhall's presidency. As Clough was the complete officer of Mazur, so Harris was the antithesis of Brimhall. Whereas Brimhall had no orthodox earned degree of any kind, Harris was the first president to have a doctorate degree, having graduated with a Ph.D. from Cornell. He had been one of the top officers at Utah State Agricultural College before being appointed here. At the time he became president, the school was really not organized as a university. He changed this by reorganizing three loosely organized colleges and by creating two new colleges. Also, at the time he became president, the BYU had not been accredited by any of the accrediting agencies. He immediately began to work for accreditation. During the first 5 or 7 years of his administration, he had so improved the organization of the school, the quality of the faculty, the curriculum, and established such improved standards of scholarship for students that the Brigham Young University became accredited by all the recognized accrediting agencies. This was a major accomplishment, and changed the school from what some thought was nothing but a glorified high school to a university. He also was responsible for the enlargement of the Brim Hall building, the construction of the Heber J. Grant Library, the Joseph Smith Memorial, and other buildings. But the depression of the 30s prevented the ultimate realization of his goals. He was a great internationalist and world traveler, more so than any president of the university. On one occasion, he was invited by the International Jewish Organization to investigate the prospects of Jewish colonization in Russia. He was chairman of the delegation which went there and spent over 6 months touring that country and making a careful examination. He recommended the establishment of a separate Jewish state in the Soviet Republic. His recommendations were accepted by the leaders of the Soviet Union and the state of Birobidzhan, which was established for that purpose, still functions in Russia. Even so, the Jews form only a minority of this particular state, which has survived as a state in the Soviet Republic for 44 years. In 1926, he was invited to give a leading paper at a World Conference for Leaders of Agriculture in Tokyo. With the consent of his board, he used this as a beginning trip around the world, which lasted for 1 year, during which he visited a great many universities to obtain ideas for this school. Finally, he was invited by the Iranian government to come to that country and organize their Department of Agriculture. This assignment also lasted a year. As a result of these trips around the world, Brigham Young University became well known, and in some respects, known internationally more than in the United States. In 1945, he resigned to become president of Utah State Agricultural College, being convinced that as an agriculturist, he could probably do more good for the rest of his career by being in Logan than continuing in Provo. Indeed, his greatest friend on the Board of Trustees, John A. Widsoe, advised him that the appointment would cap a brilliant career. Harris served as president for 24 years, longer than any other president. In order to equal that record, President Oakes will have to remain as president until 1996, which under present rules would be his age of retirement. President Harris was succeeded by President Howard S. MacDonald. And since Harris's resignation was known well in advance of leaving the school, there was a great deal of speculation among the faculty, as there generally is, as to who would succeed and to be the new president. Carl Eyring, one of the deans, quipped that from the gossip on the faculty, he'd heard of several men who had already been appointed president. MacDonald had his doctorate degree from the University of California. His appointment was of the dark horse variety. He'd been superintendent of schools in Salt Lake City for a very short time and had not been mentioned among the dozens who were ambitious or who had been named by their friends. The Second World War ended just before he took charge, and he was faced with a deluge of students which the BYU was not prepared to take. In fact, student enrollment jumped from 1,500 to 5,500 during the 4 years he was here. He managed to take care of these students by obtaining surplus property from an army base in Ogden, which he converted into dormitories, and by appealing to the loyal citizens of Provo to take into their homes as many students as they could. He served for 4 years when he resigned to become president of Los Angeles City College and Los Angeles State College of Applied Sciences, which had an enrollment at that time about three times the size of the BYU. He was a devoted church member and was accustomed, however, to working in state universities where the trustees made overall decisions and then left the administration to the president. His association with the BYU Board of Trustees, in which the board took a part in the day-to-day administration, was a new adventure to which he did not adjust very readily. He was a very vigorous man and didn't like the board to turn down any of his recommendations. At one time, he made a recommendation for the expenditure of several $1 million for a building program, as a result of which some members of the board called him the spendthrift from California. Compared to his successor, he was a piker. At one time, he proposed a 25% increase in salaries. That was really more than the board could take. During his 4 short years, he did accomplish many things. One, in response to an assignment given to him by the presidency to study whether or not this school should be abandoned, he reported it should not, thus ending the last of many challenges to the continued existence of this university. Two, he took care of the phenomenal increase in students. Three, he established a modern health student center. Four, he made a study of faculty salaries of surrounding schools, which made the board conscious of the low salaries here. Five, he aroused the Board of Trustees to a sharp realization of the need for new permanent buildings. They, in turn, authorized the Iring Science Center and the George Albert Smith Fieldhouse, which set the stage for the greatly increased building program under yours truly. He was also responsible for persuading the Board of Trustees to have Utah County Stake establish church branches on the campus. Finally, he made a major reorganization of the entire student organization so that it more nearly met the needs of a growing student body. There was a period of 1.5 years between the time of McDonald and the administration of yours truly, which was presided over in a very dignified manner by Christian Jensen, who had been called out of retirement for that purpose. McDonald was succeeded in 1951 by yours truly. I had three distinct advantages over prior presidents. One, my philosophy accorded entirely with the philosophy of the Board of Trustees, which was to set the policy. The president should administer that policy. The faculty should be involved in administrative matters only to the extent the president requested. And even then, their decisions were only advisory. This got me off to a very good start with the Board of Trustees. Two, my predecessors had laid a good foundation for future growth, especially Presidents Harris and McDonald. Three, the church for the first time was not in financial difficulty and could therefore spend more on education. Fortunately, this coincided with the administration of President David O. McKay, who was a great champion of education. As to the accomplishments which occurred during my 20 years, suffice it to say that I've been given much more credit than that to which I'm entitled. For the credit belongs to the Board of Trustees and the faithful tithe payers of this church who paid the bill. During that period, the student body increased in size 6 times, the faculty 5 times, the budget 7 times, and a building program which cost well over $100 million was completed. In my opinion, the 5 main accomplishments during the administration, my administration, in the order of their importance were: 1, the founding of 10 stakes on the campus composed of 100 wards to serve the religious needs of the students. 2, the distinction of becoming not only the largest church-related, but the largest private institution of higher learning in the country. 3, the vast improvement of scholarship among the students, which, according to a survey at one time, increased as dramatically as did the size of the student body. And 4th, which is less important, but which was indispensable for the other 3 accomplishments, the development of a great campus, which is claimed by many to be the most beautiful campus in America. And 5th, the authorization to found a law school. Neither time nor duration of his present tenure permits even a summarization of the appraisal of the Oaks administration. Suffice it to say that he's carrying on in the fulfillment of the prophetic utterances of Mazur, Cleft, Brimhall, Harris, McDonald, and yours truly. In my humble judgment, presidents of the university have the same prophetic powers with respect to the BYU as the president of the church has with respect to the church as a whole. Principal Mazur likened it to a banyan tree which would spread its branches far and wide to take roots for themselves. Given the right kind of soil and encouragement, it could spread to the entire world. President Clough, in a letter from Ann Arbor when he was earning his master's degree, wrote to acting President Brimhall, "I'm well pleased with the way you're conducting the school. I think it is now fully demonstrated that it is not so much the man who stands at the head of the academy as it is the spirit which actuates the school. For in my hands it did not lose much of its importance, and now in yours it continues steadily on its onward course." President Brimhall prophesied, "The time will come when the cry will not be where we shall get the money, but how we shall use the money that we have." This utterance, President Oakes informs me, has not yet been fulfilled. President Harris, in one of his initial addresses, exclaimed, "Behold the greatest campus in the world, in embryo." We then had only the Mazur and Brimhall buildings on this upper campus. President McDonald prophesied that under the leadership of inspired men, the BYU would become a great university. In 1954, I bore testimony to the faculty as to my views in the following words: "No one who accepts the restored gospel will question the prophecies of the prophets of the Lord that this day, or that the time will come when this school will have on it the greatest body of scholars in the world, because they will have as their source of knowledge the learning not only of men, but of the source of all knowledge, revelation from our Heavenly Father, and because they will be responsive not only to the scholarship of men, but to the testimony and promptings of the Holy Spirit." The faculty at that time had only begun to assume its present academic stature. In 1971, in another address to the faculty, I expressed the hope that all who are associated with this university will never forget that it was started by a prophet of God, and that prophets still guide its destiny. "No statement that I can make to you now," I said then, "will give me more satisfaction than to say that BYU is now the university that many dreamed it would become." President John Taylor, the successor to Brigham Young long before the close of the last century, predicted, "Zion will be as far ahead of the world in everything pertaining to leadership and learning of every kind as we are today in regard to religious matters." Later, Francis M. Lyman, president of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, proclaimed, "This school will be needed in the millennium." We now aspire to fulfill the dream of Honorable Charles H. Malik, former president of the United Nations General Assembly, who voiced the fervent hope that someday, and I quote him, "a great university will arise somewhere, I hope in America, to which Christ will return in his full glory and power, a university which will, in the promotion of scientific, intellectual, and artistic excellence, surpass by far even the best secular universities of the present, but which will at the same time enable Christ to bless it and act and feel perfectly home in it." That the Brigham Young University will become that great school, I pray in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.